Moving to one of the oldest standards now, but a recent amendment, IAS 7. I'm going to make room at the table for one of our other board members, Nick Anderson, to join us as well. Before I hand over for the paper itself, I think Katrina was just going to give a little bit of context for this paper.
So yes, in obviously having prepared this paper, I know a number of you had commented that it looked a little bit different to some of the papers that normally come. So we thought it might be helpful not only to explain to you as committee members, but to anybody else listening a slight bit of background, because it is a little different in some respects, although we think it's very similar in the end, in a sense, which is why it's coming before you for discussion. So what's different about it is, at least to my knowledge, it's the first time we've actually been approached and heard some concerns directly from investors about requirements that we're bringing to you for discussion. And so typically we talk about questions that come up around recognition and measurement, but in this instance, therefore, it's about disclosure. And so in this instance, what happened is we've received feedback from several investors who were expressing the concerns that you read in Appendix B in the submission. Now, as we say in the submission, we then drafted the submission on their behalf to reflect their concerns, and we ensured that we then sent what we drafted to those investors to ensure that it sort of correctly and accurately captured their concerns. Now, in a sense, as I say, the reason that when we looked at that, we thought it was that you as the committee are perfectly placed to address this and look at this, is that in the sense it's really no different to other types of any other questions, in fact, we've been discussing already or will discuss later. It's just in this instance it's about disclosure. So, for example, we bring this together as a package of concerns about investors, but equally these could have been individually sort of written up as questions about that, say, in applying these disclosure requirements in IAS 7, you know, am I required to link from the reconciliation to balance sheet amounts about liabilities? And actually what the concerns identified that came through from investors is that there is actually diversity, you know, there in practice, which again is often the background to the questions we get. Having done that as well, by the way, we did note that the current due process handbook actually talks about this almost. So in the section that talks about the types of questions that might come to the board or committee about standards, one of the examples listed are concerns expressed by investors about disclosure requirements. So hopefully if that's helpful, just gives a bit of context as to how and why we're talking about this.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or is that helpful? Okay. Am I handing over to you, Nicolette?
Yes, sir. Okay. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, committee members.
As Petrina alluded, Agenda Paper 5 discusses investor concerns about disclosure relating to changes in liabilities arising from financing activities, applying paragraphs 44A to 44E of IAS 7. This paper considers whether the application of existing requirements of IAS 7 leads to disclosure that meets investor information needs or whether standard setting is required. Our analysis is outlined in paragraphs 22 to 56 of the paper and considers whether the requirements of the standards addresses investor concerns. Specifically, as highlighted in paragraphs 23, we analysed whether IAS 7 and IAS 1 require an entity that provides an IAS 7 reconciliation to use consistent definitions that enable an investor to link items in the IAS 7 reconciliation to other areas of the financial statements and to disaggregate information sufficiently and provide adequate explanation of items in the reconciliation. Paragraphs 57 to 59 summarize our conclusions. We conclude that the requirements in IAS 7 and IAS 1 provide an adequate basis for an entity to disclose an IAS 7 reconciliation that enables investors to evaluate changes in liabilities arising from financing activities. I would now like to draw your attention to question 1 on page 18 and ask if you agree with our analysis and conclusion summarized in paragraphs 57 to 59 of this paper.
It's more a question. Sorry for that. I've understood why no outreach has taken place. But on the other hand, if the view and the observations of the investors are right, and we have such a clear IR7, I would assume that the enforcers might have a specific view on that, because the concerns of the investors might also be reflected by enforcers and enforcers' activities. Because if the disclosures of IR7 are not fulfilled adequately, I assume some actions have been taken with regard to that, and I would be interested to hear whether from that perspective we have seen some actions or so. So sorry for the question. It probably doesn't fit into that, but I assume it's an important one.
I think this is a question to our side.
I think it's a good guess.
And we would have we would have thought that it would have been better if there would have been some outreach to us before this paper was brought to the table. We have, in ESMA, done a survey on the application of this provisions of IS7. We reported that in our activity report, which was published at the beginning, I think by the end of March this year. What we concluded is that in 80% of the financial statements we reviewed, and we reviewed in total in Europe 92 financial statements, there was this information provided. There might be a disconnect between what is said by the investors and what was concluded in our report. And the question is then, is there an expectation? There seems to be an expectation gap between what is reported in the financial statements and what is asked for by investors. And is that because there is an incorrect application standard, or is that standard is not that clear, and that investors have higher expectations from what is reported? So, for us at the moment, that is not clear. We have enforced in some cases when we faced inconsistency with the standard, but the question is, are we going far enough based on what is in the standard and based on what are the expectations? So we are not sure whether a tentative agenda decision at the moment should be published. We would have preferred further outreach.
With that feedback, because my second question would have been, what is the need of the investors, and is there a unique need of investors, or is it a bandwidth, so to say? And what we did within the agenda decision, or tentative non-agenda decision, was more or less to explain how we might generate to come to certain figures. Some might be alternative performance measures or something like that, and how we would do that in a consistent way. However, whether we have fulfilled all the need of investors or so, there might still be a question mark beyond. So overall, I mean, I understood the paper. I see the way, or the reading was in the tentative agenda decision was a little bit, I would say, long-lasting, but it's understood why we as a standard setter believe that the standard is sufficiently clear, at least to cover the core needs of investors, and that would be my summary. So with that, I'm okay. But I'm not sure, as Ton mentioned, whether this is the end, so to say.
I want to bring Nick in, because Nick's did a lot of these himself, and he can give us an investor perspective, which is why we've invited him to the meeting. But Makoto, did you want to speak first, and then I'll bring Nick in?
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for Martin to raise the enforcement issue on this. And the ISCO committee one does not have any kind of a conclusion on this topic, so that this is just my personal impression, but you know that this agenda decision and also that analysis, I do not have any strong objection to this, but as Tom mentioned, that you know that this is also that very important for the enforcement, and there may be a kind of expectation gap. And also that the content of this agenda decision could be very strongly related to the primary financial statement, so that we should consider very carefully on the influence to the primary financial statement exposure draft that could be published shortly before the end of this year. That's it. Thank you.
Nick.
Yeah. Thank you and good afternoon, everyone. My background, it was as an investor before I joined the board. And indeed, investors have been asking for better information here since I think 26 of us wrote to the FT in 2008, encouraging companies to make voluntary disclosures here. And the things which we flagged in that letter was that we couldn't reconcile net debt from the cash flow statement, that some disclosures weren't given, and that what was provided was often opaque. So looking at what we have today in this reconciliation, which is slightly different, which is just about liabilities arising from financing activities, the same issues seem to be apparent. Now, I don't think there's any issue about many companies providing this information, but the numbers don't add up. You can't do, when you do the maths, they don't reconcile. And that is one of the issues that staff have identified based on the feedback that we've had from investors. And the other one is I think the other main one is the insufficient disaggregation. And so there's one example where the preparer says, actually, this is the reconciliation item. It's one number, which is just maths, actually, with no information what's contained in that number. And so, again, that really doesn't help investors in any way whatsoever. I think still what they're looking for is ideally is a net debt reconciliation. The board felt they couldn't go there, and so we are now seeking to bring together what is in essence a debt reconciliation, the liabilities arising from finance activities, with the cash flow statement for the investors to do their own net debt reconciliation. But as I say, in many cases, the numbers simply, either because of errors or missing data, they were incomplete. Mm. And, of course, when it doesn't reconcile, that's when confidence levels start to fall.
And just if it's helpful to say that, to reconcile, to your point, Tom, is that when we received these concerns, we felt it was important that we did our own research as well, because it was important to identify, for example, where the concerns around the fact that investors want a net debt reconciliation, but that's not what the requirements say, etc. So a very important part of what we did was our own research off the back of that, which obviously we explain in the paper, and that also is the explanation for why we didn't do outreach on this before bringing it to you, because having done all of that research, we felt at least we had sufficient information to bring this to you in terms of what we saw in financial statements. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Bertrand.
Maybe just a remark after what you've just said, because I felt it was really interesting I think it's interesting to tell you that our auditors, at least in France, they forbid us to perform a net debt reconciliation in the financial statements. And the main reason is because net debt is a non-GAAP measure, and they think that financial statements and notes to the financial statements, we are not allowed to provide any non-GAAP measures in those, except in the operating segment section. So what generally companies do, they do two reconciliations, one in the notes to the financial statements, which is generally based on cash and cash equivalents. And honestly, I think, I'm speaking for Vivendi, all the the analysis of the gross liability and the cash and cash equivalent sections, they are provided in proper notes within the financial statements. So what is asked, I think, by investor, if my understanding is correct, to analyze the gross financial liability and the movements in the gross financial liabilities or in the cash and cash equivalents, it's done. And we perform, so then we have an internal cross-reference between the cash flow statements and the notes to the financial statements back and forth. Then the net debt reconciliation is provided in the annual report, which is not part of the financial statements and the notes to the financial statements, which is not then part of the certification by the auditors. They review the information, but it just and in their report they provide their remarks based on, or if they have no remark, they say that, but just based on a review of the annual report, and we provide then effectively a net debt reconciliation on the cash flow statement using potentially non-GAAP measures in the annual report, where we reconcile to the note to the financial statements. But the auditors, they refuse us to provide the reconciliation from the notes to the annual report, because then we would implicitly incorporate some reference to non-GAAP measures in the notes to the financial statements. They do not want to certify. So we have to deal with this complexity. So I think it's more, and it's what I said to the staff when I commented on the paper, because obviously the conclusions, I'm fine with the analysis, I'm fine with the conclusion, I have no problem with the agenda decision itself. I mean, honestly, everything is very fine, but there is a more key question for the board members there, and for the ISB as a whole, the question is more around the projects relating to primary financial statements and non-GAAP measures. Because there we have a bit of a complexity. So, because you referred to net debt reconciliation, and we will never be able to provide a net debt reconciliation in the notes to the financial statements, because we are precluded to do so by the auditors and the enforcers also.
That's
so, but we provide the information, but somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Okay. At this stage.
That's interesting for us to know for PFS, but can we focus, if we could, on the analysis and the paper on the IAS 7 question. Bonnie?
I think my comments are somewhat along the lines of where Martin's was. When I started to read the paper, I thought it very strange and very odd that the IFRIC was being asked to do something that I personally think is the job of the regulators in terms of how IFRS is applied and whether or not a company is actually applied it, particularly if you think about the third question regarding errors. That to me is an internal control issue. Has nothing to do with the application of IFRS, frankly.
Is it errors or is it potentially a misunderstanding? It might well be that.
It could be either. I don't know without kind of looking at the research, but I find it a little bit outside the scope of what the IFRIC is intended to cover. That being said, I think without going into a ton of detail, I understand the investors want all kinds of information, some of which we do provide, some of which we don't provide. I think it's interesting that a net debt reconciliation is required because I'll speak for Fiat Chrysler, we have provided it in the past because that was something that management focused on. That was a non-GAAP measure, not in our financial statements, but outside the financial statements. We no longer provide it because it's not a significant measure, nor do we provide any guidance on it anymore. However, the banks want to see it, so it's in a supplementary schedule that we furnish to the SEC after the fact and give to investors. We believe, met the requirements of IAS 7. From what we put in our financial statements, but a lot of the information is outside the financial statements in an investor deck or other things. So I will focus on, I don't disagree with what the staff has concluded. I think I have a more conceptual issue that I feel like this isn't within the remit and the scope of the IFRIC. I don't disagree with kind of the analysis that was done.
I think your point on the error, but this is probably fair, and maybe we should think about not focusing on that. But in terms of the parts of the agenda decision which are basically pointing to the requirements and the standard, I think for me that is pretty similar to our day job here at the committee, even if it came from an investor question. Well, I think it is our day job. I don't think it's similar to. But anyway, okay, I'll let others comment.
I think it blurs the line of some of these things of analyzing whether or not specific companies, and I know you don't name any specific companies, but looking at filings and have they applied IAS 7 or not. To me, it feels like the job of a regulator. And maybe this is just the U.S. part of me that's that's coming through. I'm not sure. But, you know, in the U.S., the SEC, I would imagine, would be looking at this. I'm not, again, not telling the SEC or the regulators how to do their jobs. But I found this a bit odd.
Catherine, do you want to comment?
Yeah, just in case it helps us all. In terms of the extent to which we did research and looked at what companies were doing, it was to assess whether what we'd heard from investors was reflected in financial statements. You know, we wanted to do our own research of what is the problem that we're trying to address in this paper. The reason why I think we, in preparing the paper and doing all of this work, were comfortable in the fact that it had come in this direction and comfortable in writing the paper for the committee was that, and almost in reflection of something Tom said as well, that there's a way to look at this that personally I feel is very valid, which is you've got some preparers applying the requirements in this amendment and concluding, for example, that they need to make sure that everything in their reconciliation, should they choose to comply by preparing a reconciliation, needs to be linkable to other places in the financial statements. Ultimately, that is what allows investors to understand the full where that things are being financed, but some are reading the requirements to say that needs to be done. Others are reading those requirements and applying those requirements because, as Tom said, this does exist in most financial statements, but they are not seeing that they need to do it in a way that explicitly does that linkage. So in terms of the possibility of diversity in the sense that we've got some companies doing it one way, having read these requirements, and some doing it another, we felt that it was similar in principle to what the committee would do with recognition and measurement questions.
That makes sense to me. I didn't quite get that from what was in here. And maybe it was because I was a little bit influenced by the errors. Because that to me has nothing to do with accounting. If a company can't get the numbers right, then that's a completely different issue.
And we understand that when we agree, and you can assume errors will come out of the of agenda decision, but again, just to emphasise, the research piece that we did was simply background research. We wasn't trying to do anything more than that, and then what we were trying to flow through in the tentative agenda decision, to Sue's point, is just like any other tentative agenda decision in the sense that it's just pointing to particular requirements and what they say.
Bruce?
Thanks. I kind of felt the same as Bonnie a bit. In a way, when I kind of read this, I was trying to work out what we're being asked, and I'll take you through my thought pattern very quickly. My initial comment when I finished reading this paper is that this is an issue for the auditors to fight, not for us. I mean, we're talking about, are people disaggregating enough? Are they? And I agree, we're not going to focus on the areas. But these are things to me that felt like, well, the stand's telling us what to do. If people aren't doing it properly, then the auditors, stroke regulators, need to pick up on that. If I took a look at the issues that are being faced here, I mean, if I analysed that, and I'm going to use that where the disclosure initiative is going in terms of that, the one is there an overall high-level principle? Yes, there is. So the stands are telling us what to do on that. Two, do we need specific disclosures on that? Well, I think until you've done outreach, we can't answer that question. So I think that what we're answering here is we're saying, yes, we think there are overall principles saying you need to disaggregate, you need to give some disclosures in IAS 1 and IAS 7. But if we're saying, hang on, we need specific disclosures around net debt and exactly how it's done, well, then we've got to do outreach to determine whether we need to do standard setting on that. Because the only way we can add in additional requirements for that reconciliation is to change IAS 7. There's nothing in the standard that says to me, that currently says to me, we're going to get there with the wording that's there. So what I'm going to say is my view on the agenda decision is, Look, I'm happy to support it in its current format, and I think you can, because I think all it's really doing, and we were talking about this earlier, interestingly, is it's almost kind of repeating what's in the standard. Great, I'm happy with those high-level principles. So if we really feel we need to reinforce that, go for it. I don't think we're going to change anybody's practice in what we're issuing here. What's worrying me is if you're asking the question of do we need to do standard setting around these specific net debt disclosures in IS7, I think we can't answer that until we've done outreach to determine whether this is a big issue in the market or not.
Do you mean by doing standard setting? Do you mean defining net debt?
I'm saying we don't know. Is it such a big issue that
it could be that?
Absolutely, and I'm saying until we've done the outreach to determine how big an issue that is for investors, regulators, who shareholders, whoever may be using it, we can't conclude on whether we think we need to do stand setting on that specific issue. So yeah.
Carl?
Yeah, quite similar thoughts to Bonnie's and Bruce. First, I think the difference of this agenda decision for others is this agenda decision in particular is mostly a repetition of the standard, which is quite simple and clear in terms of the paragraphs of the wording of the standards. It seems to me we are simply doing a repetition of that. And to me, it seems an excessive way of using agenda decisions. It seems an unnecessary agenda decision. I can see the background discussion and the amount of implementation problems discovered, but to me, as said before, it seems much more errors or problems with enforcement than an issue to be addressed by the committee at this moment. Another comment, it seems to be a small post-implementation review done through the Interpretations Committee. I'm not quite sure about this approach as well. So I experienced the same level of discomfort
from Bonnie. Carl, a lot of the questions that we get on recognition and measurement,
where we are aware of diversity in terms of outcomes,
we end up agreeing on agenda decisions which pretty much repeat the requirements but just remind people that those requirements are there. It's fairly similar.
Somehow we do more articulation in most of the agenda decisions. This agenda decision is a repetition of.
You look at paper 10 for this meeting, that IFRS 15 question. It's simply a very narrow piece. We look at the IFRS 16 question. You look at paper 6, talking about sale of a single asset entity.
I do not object. I can vote in favor. But I'm concerned with this approach, again, more volume and in terms of the proper allocation of our time to discuss.
I'll just make one other comment, and then I'll try and shut up because I shouldn't speak too much. But I think we need to be careful that the committee doesn't inadvertently send a message to the market that we don't care about disclosure as much as we do about recognition and measurement. Mm. Mm. Reinhardt?
I think the staff's articulation of why this came to a tentative agenda decision was helpful to me, because I had a very similar reaction to Carl, Bonnie, and others when I read it. It sounded more like an enforcement a decision by an enforcer, and it did sound to some extent like, as Carl said, a bit of a post-implementation or a light touch on a post-implementation review. And I understand the basis, and I absolutely agree that as a committee we should not be afraid and should tackle disclosure issues. But what troubles me a little bit is I'm not sure what the issue is. Is the issue that the standard's not clear and that's causing errors? Mm-hmm. Is it because there's concern about level of disaggregation? And so along the lines of what others have suggested, do we need to more carefully define through outreach or otherwise what exactly is the issue so that we can provide helpful guidance to specifically address that issue? Because as reading through the agenda decision without the background, I wasn't sure what we were trying to get at, other than, you know, rearticulating what essentially is an IS7, and so that's what I was concerned about. And so what I was wondering about is whether, it would have been, rather than an agenda decision, at least at this stage, helpful to have education material as opposed to an agenda decision. But again, that's because, as I say, I just worry about whether what issue are we exactly addressing and what's causing the issues in practice.
Jim?
I think IS 1 and 7 are not new standards. They've been out there for years. And so are the foundation, the board, and this committee. Why the question is just coming in? I think it's not about ignoring the quality of the disclosure. It's not our job, main job, to do this. Recognition, disclosure, and measurement should be coming first, and the disclosure. I think it's some best practice saying that when in doubt, disclose. If it's important, significant, or the most of your investors should know, you disclose. That's the general rule, right? You don't write all these accounts and the formats and the calculations to tell the companies to disclose. We can't, because if you ask this group of people, the net debt might be an issue. You ask hundreds of the investors, I bet 90% of them will say disclosure is not enough. I've been doing that for years as a corporate accountant. That's IR's job, to communicate the numbers, the logic behind, and putting the accounting error aside. I think Kathy mentioned, if you open up your full book to the investors, they will know, if no error, all the links. They look at all these journal entries, all these the final closing and all the year-end closing, all there, but they can't. And it's not the job of financial disclosure to give them the full linkage. Some, of course, for confidentiality, some for practical reasons. So it's weird for these couple of the group of people to bring up this question, and we can't answer that. We give them the answer, and the companies or the industries or this group of investors should communicate better at their practical level, not at this level. We can't give them a format to follow. Net debt. Some instruments may not be classified as debt, so they're excluded from the table or the calculation. Who knows? Maybe timing issues. So it's not, I don't think it's our job to give them a clear answer, even though we care. We could give them industry best practice. I think Tom mentioned higher expectations. I don't think it's even higher expectation. It's different expectation or unique expectation. That's it. So we don't know how widespread, as I think as Carl or Bruce mentioned, how widespread this format or how important this requirement could be that calls upon us to give a specific interpretation or to change the standards. It's not, I don't think it's the main job for us to do, even though we care.
I think there might have been a both Nick and Catherine.
I'm scared they might have a heart attack. So
I'm going to fight between yourselves about who goes first. I just wanted to respond to, I think there were a couple of specific questions within that I will just comment on, and then I will we'll go to Nick. But with regard to your point about linkage and what is and isn't within our remit, to the extent in this paper which we are commenting specifically on linkage, it's in response to the requirement in paragraph 44D of IAS 7, which requires where an entity discloses such a reconciliation, it shall provide sufficient information to enable users of the financial statements to link items included. So it is to do with that. And the other thing I just wanted to mention with regard to your comment about the length of time IAS 1 and 7 have been around and how this is coming about now, everything that we are discussing is in relation to the amendment that became effective in 2017 on this particular topic. So I just wanted to clarify those couple of things.
I use the word linkage loosely to tell, to all the way back to our journal entries. That's all the details and the linkage, where it comes from. If we open up the full book, they will see the linkage. to each and every number. And that's what I mean, not specific to that question, sorry about that.
So in 1997, UK GAAP introduced requirements to have a net debt reconciliation. And if you look at the papers that formed that requirement and the evidence drawn by what was the UK Accounting Standards Board, the main proponents of that requirement were actually the companies. It was the preparers saying that this would really shine a light on how our business was generating cash flows and the way it generated cash flows. And that's where in the UK certainly investors got used to having net debt reconciliations as a way of giving a full picture of both cash flows and things that they consider to be economically equivalent to cash flows. Now, more things are coming into that latter category all the time, whether it's because of what we're doing with leases or reverse factoring, for instance. So more and more things are bypassing the cash flow statement because they are not cash flows. But to the investors' minds, they are economically equivalent. So I think this is a place where actually having that reconciliation, that linkage, really does help investors understand the businesses which they are choosing or not to invest in. And just probably the second thing for me on the outreach question, investors have made it very clear what their requirements are here, and they've done that over a protracted period of time. And I think if we look at our last two agenda consultations, in terms of investor feedback, this comes very high up the list. Our response to this, rather than giving a net debt reconciliation, has been to supplement the existing cash flow statement with the reconciliation of liabilities arising from financing activities to try and bring those two together. And I think the point that Catherine was making earlier is that it's in some respects, preparers are not taking that overview of working out how all these pieces join together. And in some respects, the outcome of that may be errors because they're not looking at that. It's not errors in their own right. It's just not taking that big picture. How do these things all hang together?
And maybe I'll only add, if it's helpful to say, Reinhard, you brought up the point, and I understand, by the way, in reading this paper, you might say, but how do I know this will make any difference? Are we addressing the right questions or not? I suppose what we did is say, in hearing concerns, we then importantly did our own research. So I suppose what you see then coming through is findings from our research. Now, I think I hear you could have said, maybe rather than just explain the background to our research in a couple of paragraphs, maybe we could have, you know, fleshed a lot of that out. But we were also cognizant that it would kind of be inappropriate of us as ISB staff in a public paper to potentially show disclosures of particular companies or whatever. So we tried to do this in an appropriate way with research done to try and identify where we think potentially we could be helpful. And at least based on that research, we felt that if the committee felt able to just point to what the requirements are really saying, that could potentially provide something very helpful ultimately to investors.
Just I want to add 2 points. First of all, cash flow is important. And to certain maybe industry or region or investors, net debt concept is also important. I admit I am fully in support with the cash flow and all these requirements. I'm saying that's just not this level of the decision making or the communication. That's because we, as the global body of accounting standards or interpretation authorities, cannot effectively and efficiently solve these questions. Because if you ask this specific group of investors, they will give you the format or the calculation or what they want. But if you extend to all the other investors, which there's billions of them, will give you different answers. And that we could not set in the principle-based format to tell them all insurance companies, net debt may not be a key component of disclosure. I could figure maybe most of the financial institutions may not thinking net debt as a key category of disclosure. But maybe to some manufacturing or in certain area, it's important. So I think this kind of questions should be solved through investors' relations, through the roadshows, through the communication between the companies or the industries to their specific investors. Just that's my point. I'm not saying it's not important. To these investors, they are important issues.
But in the first instance, where I think the staff is analysing quite a simple set of questions, which is, do you agree that these are the requirements that the board has put into IAS 7? It's not anything broader than that.
Goro?
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just seeing that so much confusion among committee members. And as an only representative, the users, community, as far as the staff analysis and recommendation, it is really hard for me to disagree with them. And the wording of the agenda decision appears to be okay, even for me. But having said that, my key concern is whether the proposed agenda decision would actually change the practice of the preparers. We do not provide investors with sufficient information on the change in their liabilities arising from financing activities or not. I think that this is exactly probably be shared with other members. And so that this is somewhat irritating. I think the preparers believe their disclosure is adequate enough to provide investors with sufficient information as required by IAS 7. In fact, their auditors accept their disclosures. So if this is the case, I doubt if this agenda decision would change those preparers' practice for the better. If my concerns prove to be right, unfortunately, then this agenda decision will end up with an ineffective one, leaving the investors continue to be frustrated. I'm seriously afraid of this result because this will surely damage the reputation of the committee and the agenda decisions among the financial statement users. And I think it is all the more important as to address their concerns seriously and effectively, given the fact that we rarely get the submission from the users. And I guess that the confusion among my colleague is probably that I think that they would also share that this agenda decision may not be effective enough to change the practice. And I know the ISB staff are handling this submission very seriously, and I deeply appreciate your efforts as members representing the users' community. And in order to be staff efforts to be more fruitful, we must make this agenda decision to be effective enough to convince those preparers who actually do not provide sufficient information required by IAS 7. In this regard, I would suggest that agenda decision to be accompanied by some educational or explanatory material, which would include good practice and hopefully bad practice, as a staff has identified during their analysis. I think that it is quite, that amazing that just 50% of the total sample provides sufficient information, even from the ISB staff's point of view. So that one of the problem is that this educational material might be quite different from that which have developed for the other agenda decisions. So maybe that we need that if the committee had the right to issue such an educational material or not. So that I think that I would be very happy if the staff could analyze if this is possible or if we have some other alternative to do so by the next time we discuss the agenda decision to be finalized. Thank you.
Mary, you've been waiting for a while. Do you want to come in?
Yeah, maybe high level and then some specific comments. The high level is, first of all, reflecting it's always hard when we do something new. And in some ways, it's shocking that Interpretation Committee has been around for almost 20 years now, and this is the first time we've had an issue raised to us directly by investors. But when we do, you know, usually when issues are submitted to the committee for consideration, the submission is developed and written by people who are accountants and therefore analyze it in the terms we normally think about. You know, here's the issue, here's diversity in practice, familiar with the criteria, you know, go through and set it out that way. And understandably, that's not the case here, because while they're very expert users of accounting information in the investor community, that not many of them are actually accountants who, you know, speak the chapter and verse the way we've been lucky enough to have some investors who do have that fluency involved. And I think, you know, maybe we have to challenge ourselves in terms of how we articulate the issues, especially in the opening paragraphs, because I think several people have said how they found kind of the background that Petrina and Nikki gave helpful in terms of understanding the paper in a different light, so that when I look at the first paragraph of the tentative agenda decision, what it sets here is the issue is do not meet their information needs, you know, basically doesn't meet expectations. And I think the issue that the staff is reporting and asking the committee to evaluate is that there is a disclosure objective that was added to IS-7, you know, and we see it further down the page, to, you know, that entities must enable investors to evaluate changes in liabilities, and investors are reporting that objective is not being satisfied. And so, therefore, the staff has done analysis to see if failure to meet that objective is due to a disconnect between the objective and then the more explicit requirements that also were added at the same time to the standard. And that really was the purpose, you know, first, that really is what they are analyzing in terms of the words of the standard versus the disclosure, the overall disclosure objective and reporting back to you here. There's this disclosure objective. Here are the requirements. Is there a disconnect? And in order to assess the assertion that, you know, the disclosure objective is not being met, the staff is reporting that it has done research in terms of looking at the information, and it's seeing that they have found at least a non-trivial number of incidences in which the disclosures and from their perspective don't meet the overall objective. So it seems that there's a valid issue, and then it's valid to say, is there an interpretive or conflict issue that requires some kind of standard setting? And they're saying to you guys, no, it isn't. But I mean, I agree that the tee up in the very first paragraph is perhaps not the most helpful in terms of translating this. It's the first time we're doing it, and we're trying to think about how to take that. So if it were framed more explicitly as is there a problem that needs to be addressed by standard setting, that the overall objective is not being, you know, does not seem to be met at the level that, you know, that we're expecting it to, then, you know, I think I've heard some people say, well, do we need to do more validation with outreach or not? I question whether it's useful to hold it off or not. So those are the specific things to this, and say to people, you know, let's remember this is the first time we're doing this, and we may not have got it all exactly right, that, you know, the first time around when we're dealing with a different constituency group. Now, the other thing that I want to flag as kind of a longer reaching consequence of this is it's a lot harder for everybody to assess materiality when it's not recognition and, you know, and measurement, but one of the things that the board is getting a lot of messages about in the context of disclosure initiative is just write, you know, focus on writing clear disclosure objectives and require and require compliance only with the disclosure objectives. And I agree absolutely with everyone here who said this is not an enforcement body and that's not our responsibility. But I think we have to learn what we have to write, you know, as an organization, yep, to back up those disclosure objectives in a way that makes them operational. Yep. And so if this committee can contribute to our, you know, moving along that learning curve and what's the right balance between objectives and requirements, both in assessing the adequacy of what we've done with the IS-7 amendments and thinking about, you know, whether anything more is needed. I think that also would contribute not just on this issue. And, you know, Nick's made a passionate plea about why this issue is important on its own, but it's also, I think, quite important in terms of our way forward on a bigger issue.
What drafting works and what drafting doesn't. Yeah.
So those are my observations. I understand why people came in with very different reactions to this paper, and I think we have to step back and think about, you know, what we're trying to say.
Gary, do you want to come in, and then I'll go back to members?
Yeah, I'll be quick, and I completely agree with Mary's comments, but sitting back listening to the discussion, I cannot think of any reason why this committee could not issue an agenda decision consistent or along the lines of what the staff's recommended. You step back, almost everything that comes to this committee, and for that matter, almost everything that comes to the board, is either diversity in practice or our expectations are not being met, you know, under some sort of standard. And that's, stepping back from the details, that's what this is all about. We had certain expectations. I mean, we wrote these things in IS-7 a few years, you know, about 4 years ago now, when I was a part of the group that helped write it. It was clear, but it never really got any attention since we issued and published that thing, in part because it was straightforward, was doable, and we had backed off on requiring net debt and a few other things in there. And was it perfect? Perhaps not, but it was really, I think it was eminently doable in it. But nonetheless, whether the words, the practice, or gee, it's only disclosure, it's not recognition measure, whatever the motives were, is very clear from the staff work. What we expected to happen is not happening in at the percentage level of expectations is that we had. And there's always outliers, you know, that overcomply or undercomply, but there's too many missed compliance issues in here. So I think it's eminently reasonable for this committee to address it. Certainly it could address it on this occasion. There's other ways you can address it as well, but something that's actually issued by here has got greater prominence and greater staying power in there than, say, educational material on the website. Another thing I just point out, this year for most companies, IFRS 16 is going to add, depending on what measure, like $1 to $2 trillion more of liabilities on a balance sheet that are going to go into this table. We deliberately did not call them debt in IFRS 16, but they certainly are going to hit the financing section, the cash flow section, which is what scopes what's in this reconciliation or not, and they are going to be there. So this footnote is going to get a whole lot more attention the next cycle through, and it'd be, if there's need for a tidying up or cleanup or refreshment, this is the year to do it. So there's more than one way to get this message out. I think this is a very effective and convenient way to help us get that message out.
And do you want to come in, and then I'll go
just
back
quickly.
To the
Some members have mentioned enforcement, and some members have mentioned auditors, as this is an issue that concerns them. But I think many issues that come to the committee do concern enforcement and auditors, because this is all about interpreting the standards, and they're bodies that are interpreting the standards. So I think this issue sits very well with others that this committee considers.
Yeah. Tony.
So I was going to say I'd like to come at it from a different angle, but in fact I'm going to agree with Mary that I see this as actually it is something similar to the other things that we do. We spent time earlier on this morning asking ourselves whether we thought the guidance in IFRS 16 was clear enough for folks to be able to estimate the incremental borrowing rate or to be able to determine the lease term. And here I just wonder if we'd phrase the question very slightly differently, we'd get a different reaction. Because we say, in the light of that feedback, the committee considered whether application of the existing requirements leads to disclosure that meets investor needs. Now, I'm not sure we can answer that because we're not investors. But we have a principle in paragraph 44A that says enable users to evaluate changes in liabilities. And I think if we phrase the question whether the rest of the guidance in that section of the standard allows companies to meet that objective, then I think that is consistent with the other things that the committee does. Mm-hmm. And so if we articulate it in that way, I think it will be consistent with the final conclusion in the paper. And given it's a new standard, we quite often get asked in connection, a new section of the standard, we are quite often asked about whether something in a new standard is clear. So I think it's actually helpful to re-emphasize the requirement so that the principle or the objective in paragraph 44A and then the bits that follow along for it and say, well, this is what they require and that's what you need to do to comply with 44A. And then the only observations I would have is I do agree with others that we should probably not tell people to avoid making errors.
Yes.
I just think that's...
eat your vegetables and get enough sleep. Yeah.
And we perhaps be a bit careful that there are a couple of musts. And whether must is a good word or whether that goes beyond what IS7 requires. But otherwise, I think if we tweak the question a bit, I'm comfortable with where this is going.
Thank you. Guy.
I'm probably going to repeat or echo some of that. It's really the first two paragraphs of the agenda decision that sort of sets everything off on the wrong footing, I think. So the compliance sort of concerns with it are paramount in part of it where we say there are shortcomings and people didn't provide X, Y, and Z, which are requirements of the standard. So you're set going into this as saying, oh, the IFRIC is trying to deal with a compliance matter, which I would echo some of the concerns around that. So And then the final paragraph is asking a question, to use Tony's words. We don't know. All we know is about do the specified requirements in the standard, are they clear, et cetera. And so I would have thought, I think it was Petrina was pointing out to me earlier, paragraph 5.14 of the due process handbook, and the words in there use the words, the ISB and the interpretations committee are responsible for blah, blah, blah. Concerns expressed by investors about poorly specified disclosure requirements. And I wonder if we could pick that phraseology up in helping framing, what the agenda decision is trying to assess here. Are the disclosure requirements, clear in terms of maybe it's against the objective or whatnot? Are these compliance issues about poorly specified disclosure requirements not? Is there some further issue with the overall standard? It's just missing the bar in terms of what investor needs are. I think that's beyond the scope of this committee as well. That's more a post-implementation review, as other people suggested. So I think if the shortcomings or compliance matters, are sort of turned on their head a bit and said, well, because of those, we're standing back and saying, is it because the disclosure requirements are poorly specified? And then we could say, well, we don't think they are for X, Y, and Z reasons. And then I think we'd have to change the conclusion in the TAD as well to link with that properly. There are a few places in the proposed agenda decision wording as well that I think may create a bit of an expectations gap. Tony used the must provide strikes me as too strong for something that, ultimately is a judgment in terms of how far I'm going to go on these disclosures in terms of meeting the objective. So I would try and very carefully avoid words that are going to contribute to a
a gap in expectations in terms of what the words say versus what we're saying in the agenda decision. But I think if the lead-in is set up properly, it is something that would make sense to go forward with.
Thank you, Young Soo.
Yeah, I want to make a few short, the comments on actually to the people's comments. The first one is the issue of regulators' issue or auditors' issue.
Sorry,
the committee. I'm sorry.
Just can't hear.
Auditors' issue or the regulators' issue. I think the committee has to think about it because auditors and regulators exist to provide useful information, the proper information to the users. And our goal as a committee is to provide some kinds, something, guidelines on how to make the proper financial statements. So in that sense, I think we have to think about the regulators or the auditors' issue. That is the first one I want to say. The second one I want to say is whether the agenda decision is appropriate or not. I just make some comments on the Reinhardt and the Guru's comments. And I think, instead of the agenda decision, educational material would be much better for this issue. I just read the agenda decision, and what I found was that the agenda decision is a more detailed explanation of the standard and was not able to find out anything that has been added to the standard. So if we provide any the guidelines, I mean the educational materials, like what is the best practice, then it would help the people much better than issuing the agenda decision. And the third one I want to say is about the experience of Korea. I just looked at some of the financial statements of Korean companies, and most of the companies are preparing the reconciliation between the balance sheet and the cash flow statement. So I wonder whether the staff has already also looked at non-English-speaking countries' financial statements also. So maybe some of the non-English-speaking countries, the financial statements would very much follow this requirement, disclosure requirement. So maybe the statistics would be as low as you expected or as you thought. That's my comment.
Probably at the more relaxed end of the scale in comparison to some others. I do see this as falling quite neatly into what we do as a committee, although I do agree with some of the comments that have been made and perhaps putting the emphasis slightly differently in here. Because if I sit back and look at this, what's happened is there's a group of people out there who approached the staff and said, we're looking at these disclosures. And then the natural point would be, well, staff would say, give us a submission then. And they said, well, give us a hand with that because we could do with it. So the staff have done that, and then we go into the due process. The question really for me is, and it comes back to one or two other comments, are the requirements in the standard clear or not? And I think that's what we are being asked to do as a committee here. Because if the requirements in the standard are clear, then that's no different from a host of other agenda decisions that we've issued, where we give a view on whether the requirements of the standard are clear. It comes at the bottom of almost every single agenda decision that we concluded the requirements are clear, and off you go.
Sufficient.
I'm sorry.
Important.
I stand corrected. But in this case, I think that's a fundamentally important point, because what it then drives us towards is what we would say to the board. Because if we didn't think the requirements were sufficient in the standard, then we might be saying to the board, you need to think about a bit of standard setting to tidy that up. Whereas if we think the requirements as drafted are sufficient, then we can stop there. In terms of the usefulness of it, I think that an agenda decision is useful because it draws attention to the point. So it makes people just think a little bit again about what they're saying. And I would expect it'll find its way into certain organizations' training material and other material that they put out, because that's what those organizations do. So I think that's very helpful. On the question of an agenda decision versus educational material, I pause a bit there, because even if you do educational material, it's very difficult to go beyond the boundaries of the standard. And so an agenda decision that talks in some detail about the requirements of the standard and takes you by the hand and walks you through them, to my mind, is helpful. And if it then concludes that they're sufficient, that's also helpful, because we can stop from a standard-setting perspective.
Thank you. Martin?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I'm not opposing against the non-agenda decision. However, I believe if you want to do the thing right, for me, the question is, what is core? And I understood that more or less core is doing the right math in terms of reconciliation, so that the numbers fit to each other and that you are, or the investors are able to set up bridges and are able to follow the bridges. So with regard to that, theoretically, that's all fine out of the non-agenda decision with regard to the wording. But in addition, I really would recommend, on the one hand, some educational material, and on the other hand, to have a look what is the XBRL taxonomy providing, and do we have any tools or task issues there? What's going on there? I've no clue with regard to that, but that could also be something which is probably worth to discover.
Thank you. Next, you've already done a board member article, haven't you, on this?
We have, in terms of just trying to encourage best practice. That was published 3 or 4 months ago, I think. Yeah.
Bertrand?
Maybe to answer Mary's question, and it will echo to what Tony and Guy said previously. I think we could effectively issue an agenda a tentative agenda decision at this stage, concentrating and focusing on paragraphs 44A to 44E of I-7. And for sure, if it's what you're asking for, I would be very happy to say yes. I mean, then my understanding of that is we need to disaggregate, as a preparer, we need to disaggregate in the notes to the financial statements the cash and cash equivalent and the gross financial liabilities movements, explaining what is cash, what might be non-cash, whatever. So, okay, that's very fine. I mean, I have really no issue. It's what we, at Vivendi, it's what we are already doing. I mean, I have strictly no issue to say that in an agenda decision. I mean, not just because we are already doing that at Vivendi. Yeah? It's not what I'm saying or what I'm hinting. But it's a narrow question, and I'm fine with that. And maybe to explain a bit my earlier formal comments, and it will echo to what Bruce and Jim said previously. Statement I-7 is about statement of cash flows, so cash generation. And effectively, the auditors initially precluded us to, or the auditors or the enforcers, both the AMF in France or the SEC in the US, because it's the countries we were at the time we transitioned to IFRS quite a while ago. But, I mean, in terms of adherence to that, I think I can say that we adhere to that today, because what we are providing, reconciling to having a cash flow statement that reconciles to cash and cash equivalents, we effectively focus on the cash generation. And then we effectively disaggregate additionally what is asked notably in those paragraph 44A, 44E of IS7. But we are focusing on cash generation, as Jim mentioned earlier. And then we reconcile to cash and cash equivalent. It's a gap measure as defined in IS7. So we effectively have strictly no problem or we provide no problem to auditors or enforcers in that. So if we were now, and I hear that there is a second question we discussed this morning,
which is net debt reconciliation. That's something else. If you're asking us about that, then it's something else. No. Net debt is not a GAAP KPI. So then it will echo what Bruce said. You will need to amend IS7, incorporate whatever standard, then effectively define systematically what net debt is. Hence, it would become a GAAP measure. So fine. But then IS7 would have to be labeled differently. Yeah. Longer,
we're trying
be
not to
statement
talk
of cash
net
flows and net debt.
Yeah. We're trying not to talk about net debt because that's not what 7 focuses on. Bonnie?
I think from my perspective, Mary's comments and Tony and whoever else mentioned this, I think is quite helpful because I think that's part of the strong reaction that I had in terms of how it was framed. And I think, you know, if the analysis is about are the standards clear, then that has to be how this is worded, and that's not how it's currently worded. So I do think that is within the remit of the IFRIC, and I think I do think we could issue a tentative agenda decision on that. I know the educational material has been mentioned, and I'm going to think there are some other points in terms of good practice or other observations that the staff had in terms of doing the analysis and the research around this particular issue in response to some of the investor feedback that I think is relevant. I don't believe it belongs here, but I'm not sure what format that would be. I don't know if it's another kind of board member saying something or educational material or something to... I do think that's good information to share. Okay. I just don't believe it belongs in the...
I'd agree with that.
...agenda decision.
Gaurav, did you have your card up again, or is your card from last time? No?
I think that the... it is very important for us to issue some kind of agenda decision, and that is that investors are expecting. But as I said earlier, and I think that many of us agree that the agenda decision will probably may not be enough. So that I think that the agenda the education part. We need to make some research. What kind of education material would be the most effective to address the investors' concerns?
Thank you. I think some very helpful suggestions have been made in terms of the content of the agenda decision, particularly sort of the front part, if I can use that technical term. Also, I think the comment on errors is a fair, very mm-hmm. fair comment. Mm-hmm. My suggestion would be that, given that we have the benefit of having the meeting going over until tomorrow, mm-hmm. that we, and because we need to change the wording quite a bit, that rather sort of than doing it on the fly, because I think it's important we all happy with the words, because it is a new thing we're doing, to Mary's mm-hmm. point, let's get it right, that we ask the staff to sort of take it away today and have a go at marking it up. Based on what you've heard from committee members, and then we could have a look at the words tomorrow. Would that be all right?
Okay.
And then we've all got time to sort of step back a little bit and then come with fresh eyes and look at the words.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Helpful discussion. So with that, let's draw the morning to a close. So we'll take a break until 2:15.
Thank you.
And thank you, Gaurav.